Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Deutschland Supertone Show.
Hey, mama said the way you move gonna make you sweat, gonna make you groove.
Led Zeppelin, Black Dog, like Hummock, our Labrador,
yeah,
hairy ears, and very black. Anyway, let's not worry about that right now. Let's talk about Led Zeppelin. This is from their untitled fourth studio album, which was released on 8th of November 1971 on Atlantic Records. Incredible, 1971. They did an awful lot of stuff in those first few years.
Yeah.
Four albums, because they started in 68.
They really worked their butts off, really, didn't they?
Unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. And again, recorded at, or for the first time, recorded at Headley Grange.
Was it Jane Seymour's house?
That's exactly right, yeah.
I always liked the fact that they were considering going to Mick Jagger's house called Stargroves.
Yeah.
Stargroves. But they said it was too expensive.
Yeah, that's all Mickey, isn't it?
Well, I mean, didn't they have a lot of money at that point?
Oh, yeah, they were absolutely loaded because, but Peter Grant, I mean, he was, and I think the thing is that Jimmy Page was really tight. I remember reading something about the first rehearsals, and he went to get everybody a sandwich and a beer or something, and he asked everybody for the money.
Did he really?
And he was really rich at the time. Boy, he was doing very well because he'd actually had a lot of success, recording success, prior to Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And he'd written songs and stuff, so he'd had a lot of royalties and, stuff coming in. So, he was pretty well, and I think he had his own house on the Thames.
That's right, wasn't it? Because didn't Robert Plant go down to meet him at his boathouse?
That's right,
to discuss working together.
That's right, yeah. And that was right at the very beginning. But, back to Led Zeppelin 4, as they call it. And it's a great album, but it's not my favourite Led Zeppelin album. I think it's the most critically acclaimed.
It is. I think they've sold over 37 million copies worldwide.
That's ridiculous, isn't it?
That's a huge amount.
Yeah. I mean, I know we talk about Led Zeppelin a lot because we've had quite a bit of Zepp on the show. And I think we've only had off this album When the Levee Breaks on before.
Yeah, the only cover that was on the album as well.
Indeed, by Memphis Minnie. She wrote it
from Memphis.
Surprisingly enough, yeah. But some interesting facts about this, of course, is that when Andy Johns recorded it, I mean, all the drum sounds were done in the stairwell in Headley Grange, and he used a couple of Beyer room mics that suspended from the balcony sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then compressed the hell out of them with the Helios console. And what I didn't know, and these notes have just illuminated me to the fact...
What's that?
..that the last solos on this track were actually recorded directly into the console. And I didn't know
that. Yes, so I put that in there. Used. I thought you'd like that.
Yeah, well, there we are. You got me
research.
There.
But what I really like is the fact that I was looking at sort of comments like John Paul Jones was saying that, at Headley Grange, they didn't have a bar and there were no leisure facilities, darling. No, so it basically just got them to focus and Jimmy Page, and that's why they wanted the Rolling Stones mobile truck, because Andy Johns recommended it because he just worked with Sticky Fingers, and he was saying that they just wanted something that they could just like wander around the garden, have a cup of tea, go in and do what they wanted, but they also could record spontaneous jams as well, which is some of the stuff that's come from this album.
Well, rock and roll was a jam, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Completely. So, and that's amazing, because when you listen to it, it's probably one of the most played Zeppelin tracks, isn't it?
And it's an absolute git to come in on time with that blinking drums at the beginning.
Yeah.
You listen to that, you go, oh! And it really is, it's almost like you just, whenever I play it, I have to use my mojo and just like go on feel and jump off like skydiving, off a big cliff.
Well, John Bonham emulated, I think it was, I can't remember which track it was now, but it was a Chuck Berry guitar intro.
Ah, and that's right.
And the timing's exactly the same as that. But the only person I've ever heard play this correctly is a guy called Nick Collings from the Isle of Man, who we played with a lot when we were over there.
That's right. He was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, and this track, he is John Bonham. He really got it. And
he studied it, though, didn't he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the thing is, whenever I came in, I used to jump up and down. We used to grin at each other, go, yeah, and then we just head down and go for it.
But you've got to watch the crash cymbal. The thing is, when he's about to hit the crash, that's when you come in, you can hear it.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway.
Oh, yeah. I'm there, braced. But anyway, I mean, what I love about Led Zeppelin, I mean, they were so, they're the marrow that runs through this era. They really are so incredible. And what I've discovered about them through your love of them as well, which is inspirational, just, when you enthuse about them, it's a bit contagious, you can't help it, is that they were, what I didn't know really was that Led Zeppelin 3 wasn't actually as well, critically well received.
Well, I had a lot of folk on the other side.
Yeah, and that, but that, see, I like that. And this is what they were saying. They turned down, to do this album, they turned down offers of a New Year's Eve gig, which is going to be broadcast on television, and they just cut a load of dates out. They did just wanted to go and focus back on working, which I, you know, I love. But you also wonder whether or not they knew they had a shelf life, if it were. You know, you've got to keep running with it and you've got to keep focused on it because with this kind of industry, there's a mojo and you never know when the bubble's going to burst. Yeah. So maybe they were just totally focused in on not dropping the ball as well.
I think you're right. And, you know, Page was very, very focused. You know, he's always been, was always very focused. I mean, as time went on and reading the book, which is very sad, actually, about his sort of demise into drugs and drink, really, and rock and roll, proper rock and roll excess in the late or mid-70s. Mid to late 70s. And, but here, he was still really on it. You know, his playing was really great. That riff, I mean, I always say that, you know, Tony Iommi is a riff master, you know, from Black Sabbath. And he is. I think he's come up with some great riffs. But, you know, this riff on this, you know, and that, is it 5/4 over the 4/4 beat?
Well, you know, I was going to ask you about that time signature because it's just really odd. It's almost like there are two time, like time splits.
That's right.
And you go into like, you know, this kind of, you know, like when you've, if you've hit your head and you see stars, you go, whoa. Yeah. It just feels like you've just been given some kind of weird drug for a moment.
That's right, because the fact that the riff is actually a different time signature than the, yeah. But it's do-do-do-do-do. It's that bit, yeah.
Yeah.
But it really, you know, it really goes against the drums, and eventually the drums catch it up because the drums are playing straight 4/4. So it catches up after, you know, after the required number of bars, darling.
And I'll tell you what I love about this album as well is when they were recording at Headley Grange, we used to have a photo, I remember on the wall, of Rob Plant sat outside on the stool playing harmonica with Jimmy Page with a guitar.
Yeah, that's right.
And, you know, there wasn't a bottle of whiskey in sight.
No.
And did you know why it was called Black Dog? Apparently there was a black dog around Headley Grange. And they named it after this black dog that was roaming around.
So perhaps we should actually call one of our tracks for the next record Black Dog. Why not?
One morning I woke up and I knew it all. A new day, a new way, and new eyes to look for. Go your way, I'll go mine. Get the sky is clearing and the night is the sun, he come, the world's all enough. Rejoice, rejoice, we have no choice but to carry on. The fortunes of fables are able to
Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, Carry On. The opening track from the second album, Deja Vu, which was also their first album as a quartet with Neil Young. And it was released on the 11th of March in 1970 by Atlantic Records and hit the top of the pop album charts for a whole week. And the I love that. When I read that, I was like, you know, you went to the charts for a whole week. Anyway, and the album produced three top 40 singles. It was Woodstock, Teach Your Children and Our House. Now, Carry On, which is what the one I wanted to play, was also released as a single, but it failed to chart.
Is that right?
Yeah, that's really weird. But overall, it sold over 8 million copies.
Yeah, it's a great record. And the only thing I've got to say about this is compression.
Right.
The amount on the guitar, right, the opening 12-string guitar, is outrageous. You can, it's squashed like a roadkill. It's unbelievable. Because as soon as it comes in, it's so amazingly compressed. And as you know, what it does, it reduces the... It makes the quieter bits louder and the louder bits quieter.
Yeah.
But when somebody's bashing an acoustic guitar like, you've got to be able to control the amount of volume on the tape.
Yeah.
But it sounds to me like they use far too much. Anyway, but it's one of the trademark things of that first track on the album. Every time I listen to it, I think, flipping heck.
Yeah.
But it's kind of cool, you know? And Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Stephen Stills, lovely guitar player, you know? But, you know, that was in 1970. That was recorded in 1970. And when you compare that with the British records that were around at that time, it's so much more sophisticated, you know. The harmonies, I mean, on British records, of course, they're beautiful and great as well. But here the sound is so, I don't know.
Shiny.
Yeah, it's sophisticated. And it was recorded at Wally Hyder's studio, wasn't it?
Studio C, I believe, in San Francisco, baby.
Now, our mate in the Isle of Man, Mark Cleeter, has some Wally Hyder preamps that were out of that studio. Yes, API, that's right. And because he had a tech working on them, and I've actually used them, and they do sound great, you know. Because what happens is that the microphone, of course, you know, you get the microphone, you plug it directly into a preamp, which amplifies it from that sort of level into line level, and you can go either directly to tape or directly into a tape machine or a mixing console or whatever. But, you know, they're a great, you know, a great tool to have in your studio, external preamps, you know, just to give you a different sound than your console. Anyway.
But that took about 800 hours, apparently, according to Stephen Stills, to do that album.
No.
Yeah, and they all went in sort of at different times and sort of laid down what they would agree on, you know, as in they recorded separately, but together, if you know what I mean.
800 hours?
Yeah, that's what, I mean, in the notes it says it may be an exaggeration. But that's what Stephen Stills said. And of course, Neil Young's only on half of those songs on that album, which is quite interesting. But, and they had some session guys in as well. I love Grateful Dead guitarist Jerry Garcia played pedal steel on Teach Your Children. And you've got John Sebastian from Love and Spoonful. He played harmonica on the title track. And what was lovely about this, you know, what really lightened my heart was that after this album, all of their individual solo albums did really well.
Yeah.
And not just one, but all of them. And I love that because after this, you had Neil Young's After the Gold Rush. You had Stephen Stills' self-titled solo debut. David Crosby had an album out, If I Could Only Remember My Name. Oh, that's actually quite a funny title. And Graham Nash had Songs for Beginners. And Rolling Stone magazine put it at number 148 in the list of the 500 greatest albums of all time in 2003.
Oh, it's a great record. And is it Ohio on this, isn't it? That's the one with Neil Young who sings that does the lead on it?
Do you know what? I can't remember.
Yeah, it is. And it's fantastic.
You can always tell when he comes into town, can't you? It's a different ball game,
actually.
Well,
he's a very curmudgeonly sort of chap, isn't he? You know, he just turns up when he wants, and he's not on all the record and all that. And he cancelled concerts with them and everything.
I know, he's right pain in the butt, wasn't he?
Yeah. It really screwed him up, didn't it? You know, because because he worked with Stephen Stills, of course, before in the previous band, and it's, you know, he's always been a pain in the ass.
And Graham Nash was from Salford, wasn't he?
He was indeed.
Yeah. Isn't that amazing
he's
as well?
The Hollies.
I love that. I love the fact you've got a guy from Salford, right? He goes over to America and he sings these great harmonies. I mean, it's just, men always get me, you know, when they're so, all right, love, you know, and they're a bit hard, you know, and you've got a bloke there and they go, na 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 na.
Absolutely fantastic. But together, and it was Joni Mitchell, wasn't it, who heard them for the first time, I think, all singing together.
In Laurel Canyon, baby.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And she said as soon as they started singing together, they knew, you know, it was going to be right and beautiful and massive.
It was a teenage wedding and the old folks wished them well. You could see that Pierre did truly love the mademoiselle. And now the young monsieur and madame have rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, say the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell. They furnished off an apartment with a two-room robot sale. The coolerator was crammed with TV dinners and ginger ale. But when Pierre found work, the little money coming worked out well. C'est la vie, say the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell. They had a hi-fi phone, oh boy, did they let it blast. 700 little records, all rock, rhythm and jazz. But when the sun went down, the rapid tempo of the music fell. C'est la vie, say the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell. They bought a souped-up chitney, was a cherry red 53, and drove it down to Orleans to celebrate the anniversary. It was there where Pierre was wedded to the lovely mademoiselle. C'est la vie, say the old folks, go to show you never can tell. Truly love the mademoiselle. And now the young monsieur and madame have rung the chapel bell. C'est la vie, say the old folks, it goes to show you never can tell.
Chuck Berry, You Never Can Tell, also known as C'est La Vie or Teenage Wedding, from his 7th studio album and 10th overall, St. Louis to Liverpool, released on November 1964 on Chess Records.
Chuck Berry, now.
Founding father of rock and roll.
How come? What did he have? What did he do?
Well, I was reading quite a lot about this.
Were you?
Yeah, well, over the years, yeah.
Okay.
And what he did is that he took that rock and roll and made it relevant to the average kid on the street. Now, bearing in mind he was black, and in that time, you know, it was still difficult for black artists to really make it in the white America, you know?
Yeah.
And, but, that rhythm that he had, because basically many of his songs are just the same. The reason why we picked that one is, well, first thing, we watched Pulp Fiction the other night.
Oh, I want to win the twist competition.
Yeah, and that scene with Vincent Vega.
It's classic. Yeah. The moves, fantastic.
Yeah, I love when he takes his shoes off and he gets on his toes.
Yeah.
And it's a great, you know, it looks absolutely fantastic. And, you know, we've been watching Kill Bill. We've been overdoing on Tarantino recently.
We have, yeah.
It's the honky-tonk piano, because it's unusual that you hear as much piano in a Chuck Berry song, because normally it's that rhythm guitar, that chunking rhythm guitar, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I think he really got the youth of America at that time, and he captured the magic, you know, riding along in my automobile, all those sort of things, you know. And
just at a time when people had money as well, when the kids had started to get their own independence, didn't they, as well?
Exactly. And it was just a beautiful time for him, I think. But, I mean, Carl Perkins toured with him and he said he, when he was in England, he was very hard, wasn't he? Because he spent quite a lot of time in jail, didn't he?
Well, I think he best part of 2 years. I was reading about this and this is, God, this is contentious and it's really difficult because I've read a couple of different reports, but the facts are that there was a law called the Mann Act.
Yeah.
That's right. And it's to stop prostitution or human trafficking.
Mm.
And Chuck Berry had a nightclub and he offered a 14-year-old girl some work in his club. And anyway, she got fired. Anyway, 3 weeks later, she went to the police and told a different story. He got arrested and he was tried by an all-white, all-male
jury.
Mm. He was given 5 years. And $5,000 fine. And then because of some disparaging remarks, he had a retrial and he was found guilty again. And so that's what happened. So, and it's difficult because before Carl Perkins was saying he would be lighthearted and jam and in life and sell the party. Mm-hmm. And he said, and also because he had a lot of he was playing a lot of one-off shows as well. He was touring a lot, and he says, but he thinks it's mainly jail that changed him. And that's just so difficult when you see that dramatic effect on somebody. And I don't want to comment because it's not for me to say. I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
But I think, you know, I mean, that is one thing, because a lot of artists at that time got, you know, caught out with various things, you know, with the law, certainly black artists.
Yeah.
But the music, you know, is the thing. And I always remember seeing that great documentary with Keith Richards, and he's playing a Chuck Berry song, and Keith Richards can't get the riff right, and they're arguing, and eventually, you know, Keith Richards, the man himself, has to succumb to Chuck Berry's seniority, both from a playing perspective and from the fact that he wrote the song.
Yeah, exactly. Get in there. A piculo. But what was also what's quite interesting, right? So this peaked at number 124 on the Billboard album charts.
Okay.
And it was the first of Chuck Berry's studio albums to chart. Now, that's interesting. You think how many albums he's done before. And it was also released as a follow-up single to his top 10 hit, No Particular Place to Glow. And it went to number 14 in the charts. And it was his final top 40 hit until My Ding-a-Ling. And that's when I discovered it, would you believe, in 1972.
That was quite saucy.
My mum used to sing it. We used to have a black and white portable.
Did she actually know what it was about?
No, neither of us did, I'm sure. We're very naive, very innocent. But we used to. I remember seeing him. Literally, I do. I remember seeing him on stage when he was singing this, and mum and I just chuckled. I think we bought it on 7-inch vinyal.
Thank you. But you just, woman, so much, it's a shame to see. You just
Eric Clapton. And Have You Ever Loved a Woman from the live album EC Was Here, released in August 1975 on the RSO record label.
Well, you know, my favourite Eric Clapton album by far. It's Best Playing, My Country Mile, as far as I'm concerned. I love the way that all the mistakes are left in there. It's great. He plays one semitone sharp towards the end there, even as one lick that he plays that's actually out of
the whole piece.
Yeah, I know. It's Eric Clapton, isn't it? But it's great. It's been left in.
It's perfectly imperfect. It's live.
And when George Terry starts playing his guitar solo, you can hear, because obviously using a Strat or a single coil pickups, you can hear the interference coming from the lights. You can hear it buzzing. Fantastic. And that's what it's all about.
I absolutely adore that track, and that's because of Carl Radle on bass.
Mm. I knew the bass was going to make its
appearance. I just thought, I'm going to get in there, because I can't wait.
Yeah.
I love the bass on that. It showed me when I first started learning bass and listening to what a bass does and where it can go and how it complements music. And it was... this track was like seeing stepping stones across a river, but you didn't know they were there because they were underneath the water, the waves, you couldn't see. But where he goes with that bass is just the notes he plays, and it's so complimentary. And listening again, I hear new things all the time. And There's that one bit when there was that real sort of intense bit, and Carl got a little bit out of that attitude. He went... And I heard that tonal, like, and I thought, blinking heck, get in there, because he comes across as very gentle. I mean, he's so laid back. He's more laid back than a laid back thing.
Yeah.
And that's so difficult to not rush. But also, he's got Old Acre on drums.
Yeah. Well, that rhythm section is amazing.
It's a dream team.
Yeah. I mean, George Terry does a great job on rhythm guitar, plays lead on that as well a bit, of course, and the keyboards. It's just a great, you know, it's a great
feel. The feel. Yeah. Isn't the feel absolutely brilliant? Produced by Tom Dowd.
Yeah.
Our friend. We love Tom. And it was Clapton's first tour since Derek and the Dominoes in 1970. And what I didn't realise, when you start to look into this album, it was recorded live on the 19th and 20th of July 1974 at the Long Beach Arena.
Hmm.
And on the 4th of December, late that year, at the Hammersmith Odeon. And finally on the 25th of June in 1975 at the Providence Civic Centre. And what I also didn't know about was the market was a bit oversaturated at the time with Clapton and Cream reissue products. And this actually got a bit lost.
Is that right?
Yeah, they were saying in the term is it got lost in the shuffle, but it remains an excellent document of the period, quote. But it's just an incredible live album, and you can feel, you know, when the crowd start to go and it plays. I mean, I can feel it now. The goosebumps.
Well, you know, and his guitar said, I think they were using Music Man amps then, and it's just great. It's a great sound. It's far better than the stuff he's doing now. I mean, he had passion, and his playing was so
like a different
dynamic
man.
And very, very powerful playing, you know, and great licks. And the whole album. I mean, you know, we've had Further on the Road on before, I think, from this record, and we'll have more on because it's a track by Bibi Blue Bland. It's called Further on the Road.
I know, we always kind of mess with that, don't we?
Every track is great. Yvonne Elliman's on Can't Find My Way Home.
Well, that's the other thing as well. So this was written by, the song actually was written by Billy Miles, first recorded by Freddie King in 1961. So a good sort of 14 years before. But he got this low-key touring band together because in 1974 he started living with Patty Boyd, the love of his life.
Indeed.
And they married 5 years later. And he was off, he was no longer using heroin, although he started to drink more heavily, apparently. But this, getting to the point, the low-key touring band, Carl Radle, who was responsible for bringing him back from his hiatus, wasn't he?
Yeah.
George Terry from Miami, keyboardist Dick Sims, drummer Jamie Oldacre, and you're right, Yvonne Elliman, and also Marcy Levy, also known as Marcella Detroit.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah, so he's got this band.
Yeah.
And that's the thing, isn't it? When you've got a band of people and he was in a really good space, wasn't he? So in 1974...
But the band were cooking. I mean, it is his best band, you know?
Yeah.
There's absolutely no doubt it. You know,
Mojo.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't like Gadd on drums with him playing. Because, you know, now Gadd plays with him, Steve Gadd. And he's an amazing drummer, Steve Gadd, but it just doesn't work, I'm afraid. You know, from my perspective, from what I've seen. I've never seen Eric Clapton live.
We need to do that.
Well, perhaps. I don't know, because I think I'd be disappointed, to tell you the truth. My Monster, Sucker for Your Sound, from the third album, A Dense Swarm of Ancient Stars, great title, released on 16th of March 2009. Now, I know nothing about this band, but you were singing along there. Talk to me about it.
Yeah, yeah, well, this is weird, right? Because this band's from Sheffield, and That's a great name for a band as well, I Monster.
It is.
Okay, so this was released, right, in 2009, and we recently played the Greystones with the Starlight Campbell Band in Sheffield. And I was thinking about Sheffield, and then I find out, and I thought, oh, yeah, yeah, I remember I've got this album from this Sheffield band. And they kind of specialise in left-field, psychedelic, new wave, electronic pop. But when I first heard, obviously we've got the album, but when I first heard it, I loved this song. And I watched the video, and it's actually two speaker boxes with animated, mouths and eyes on. And they have a little baby speaker.
No.
Yeah, you should watch it. It's really sweet. So it's like a love story. So, and it's about Sang, which I thought was great, speakers.
That is very that's really cool. But I mean, Sheffield has a massive history of electronic music. You know, the Human League, Heaven 17. You know, I mean, a lot of people came out of there, and I always remember reading an article some years ago again about the A&R guys from London, and they used to make regular trips up there to Sheffield. You know, to see what was happening. You know,
yeah.
Got the Lead Mill and all those great venues, you know.
Well, what's interesting, and what I wanted to do, I mean, there's not actually a lot on the internet that you can kind of find out about them. I know this album was recorded at the Bowling Green, and I love this, and Pig View Studios in Sheffield.
In there?
I can't believe you just did that.
Pig's in there, yeah, it's all right.
Oh, we always do that. Wyatt.
Yeah, Robert Wyatt. Great track.
That song that we played a few weeks ago. Yeah. Well, we keep... It's now part of our daily life because we go, what? I don't know, what would you go? A cup.
In there.
Yeah, that's weird. So about I Monster, though, because they're not well known. But when you look into it, their second album, the one before this, was called Never Odd or Even, and Richard Hawley plays on it.
Ah, right.
And also the band produced the Human League's Credo album.
Right.
In 2011.
Wow, there we are.
So when you think about it, there are a couple of producers called Dean Honer and Jared Gosling. So check them out, because they remind me a bit of the Earlys as well, because it's kind of comedic.
Right, okay.
And there's some beautiful context. And I just really, really like them. But also, one of their songs, The Blue Wrath, was featured in the movie Shaun of the Dead.
Great movie.
Thank you.
Fleetwood Mac and World in Harmony. And that was released as the B-side to the single, The Mighty, The Green Manalishi.
Oh,
yeah, in 1970, and that was on Reprise Records. Now, this confounded me slightly when I was looking into when it was released and what it was released on. It also features on their third studio album, which was released in 1969, Then Play On. But the remastered edition, which was released in 2013, is an extended edition. It's the final track on Rhino Records. So that got me, it took about 10, 15 minutes to, you know when you drop a load of like spaghetti on the floor and you're trying to put them all in single strands? That's what it felt like.
Well,
trying
try not
to, work
to
that out.
Drop spaghetti on the floor, darling. But no. It does happen, of course, me being Butterfingers and all that.
And me not cooking, that doesn't happen either. But anyway, carry on.
So, was it the first album that they did
without
Mike Vernon, wasn't it? Because it wasn't on Immediate Records, which was his label, was it?
Oh, I think it was. Was it Blue Horizon?
Yeah,
Blue Horizon. It was with Neil Vernon and Neil Slaven's.
Yeah, Mike Vernon, yeah. That's right, anyway, it's on Warner anyway, this one, isn't it?
Yeah.
The interesting thing is with this, and the reason why I sort of dug it out, was that it's got that incredible harmony thing going on, which a lot of people picked up on later on. Because if you listen to Wishbone Ash again,
right,
and listen to Leaf and Stream, which I think we're going to be playing the next show, actually.
Right.
Possibly.
Okay.
And on agreement, of course, between us. But... But it's got that harmony thing, and what I love about that is I love the reverb on these massive amounts of reverb on those guitars, and that's this is the last album with Peter Green on it, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Danny Cohen's playing as well, and that harmony it's just quite beautiful, you know. But something quite different than Fleetwood Mac, because they'd sort of dispense with the blues, really, because Green Manalishi wasn't really blues; it was more blues rock, you know, very much in the thing of Led Zeppelin, because Led Zeppelin were around at the time and all those early rock bands. And it's just fantastic. And what I do love about it as well is the guitar sound, so clean and clear. And that is Matt amps, of course. These are Matt amps that they were using, orange Matt amps at the time.
Fantastic
so,
amps.
Yeah, and that's what looks like we're going to be using very soon.
Well, exactly. I'm very, very, very,
very
excited about that.
Very excited about those, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and very much the British sound.
Do you know what's really funny then? Is that that's the what you've just talked about with the sound of the guitars.
Mm.
It, listening to that track, that's what struck me too.
Yeah, it's the sort of there's an airiness and clarity about the whole recording as well, which is interesting. Which, you know, a lot of British bands weren't getting at that time, and I just love it because it doesn't sound like an old recording. That it sounds like a really modern recording when it comes in. You think it was done sometime in like the late 70s, 80s. It's very, very clear and crisp. Anyway, I can't find very much about where it was recorded though, so
no.
I can't illuminate anybody on the recording, but. So anyway,
it's one of those. You know, I'm just thinking about what we're playing on the show today. It's quite an unusual mix today.
It is, yeah.
Because it's like you've thrown this one in, and I've obviously had...
The next one.
Oh, I know.
Now, the next one
coming
up is going to be very interesting, because another very, very massive guitar player and a great influence on me.
Not a word of this is true. Don't believe me if I tell you, especially if I tell you that I'm in love with you. Don't believe me if I tell you that I wrote this song for you. There just might be some other silly pretty girl I'm singing it to. Don't believe a word, 'cause words are only sports.
Gary Moore, Don't Believe a Word, from his first authentic solo album, Back on the Streets, and the Thin Lizzy cover. Phil Lynott and Brian Downey were playing on that track. And
indeed. Shit,
and old Phil was sharing the vocal duties. But unfortunately, that's the end of the show.
Wow.
Yeah, so you can catch us on Mixcloud and iTunes and all those other great things. And we look forward to seeing you next week.
I was going
to
say, thanks so much for joining us. We really love your comments as well and keep them coming in. And, you know, it's such a joy to do the show with you.